I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I love that song, and I haven't heard it in a long, long time. And actually, it figures prominently in our discussion this hour. This hour of the program, we're going to talk about Anatomy of a Song, the oral history of 45 iconic hits that changed rock, R&B, and pop. And our guest to talk about all of this writes for the Wall Street Journal. He's a regular contributor to the Wall Street Journal. He writes about rock, soul, pop, and jazz, as well as the arts. He's the author of Why Jazz Happened, and he posts daily also at jazzwax.com. And this book looks at 45, well, actually, it's 45 of his columns. They're music milestones that are arranged chronologically. He asks the question, how did rhythm and blues and rock emerge in the first place? He starts the book with a song that you just heard, which has a great story. We'll hear about it in a moment. Lordy, Lordy, Miss Charlie ends with Losing My Religion by R.E.M. And the songs were not included unless they stood the test of a generation. Lottie Miss Claudie was 1952, and we're going to hear about all kinds of other songs this hour. We don't have time for all 45, but we'll hear Otis Redding, Loretta Lynn, Stevie Wonder, Joni Mitchell, The Rolling Stones, Jefferson Airplane, The Temptations, The Marvelettes, Bill Haley and His Comets, and many other as we proceed along this hour. And welcome phone calls, too. We got a lot going on this hour, but we certainly welcome your conversation. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Hello, Mark. Thanks so much for being with us.
Kathleen, it's wonderful being with you.
Yeah, great to have you here. It was so much fun to read this because then I got to listen to a lot of the songs, and the backstories on some of these are just wonderful, aren't they?
I'm so glad you like it.
Yeah, I really did. So tell me what it needed to have happened for this to be in the book. It had to withstand the test of a generation?
Well, not so much that. I mean, I ended in 1991 because I felt that for a song to be called iconic, it kind of would mean that it needed to stand a period of time, that it sustained itself and was still great today. And I sort of asked myself, how much time should that be? 10 minutes, a month, 2 years? And I decided it should be 25 years, because 25 years is sort of a generation, and it's also enough time that all the fads and the trends and all the hoopla can burn off. And then after that period of time, you know, that's when songs, if they're still meaningful, take on a whole different shape and form.
Mm. I love the backstories on many of these songs, and I must say that Lloyd Price's story is one of the best, at least as far as I'm concerned, in the book. It's just, you know, serendipity that happens. He's talented, but such a young guy, and to have what happened to him happen is just extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is, and it's also the dawn of the 45. I mean, it's just when, you know, music goes to that, you know, little round disc with a big hole. Prior to that, everything had been on shellac. So it's sort of the very start of what we call the teenage music era.
Mm-hmm. And he's from New Orleans, right? A suburb of New Orleans,
yeah.
Poor area.
Yeah, and what makes that song so special, of course, is that, well, a couple of things. One is that backbeat. That Earl Palmer is playing drums, and you hear a very special beat there that has an emphasis on the second and fourth beat, which is what's commonly called the backbeat. And at the same time, Earl Palmer's playing these six-eighth figures on one of the cymbals. So it has a... And it's the first, really the first rock and roll beat, pure rock and roll beat. But the other, there is one other surprise, Kathleen, on that song, and that's the piano player. The piano player is Fats Domino.
Yes, that's amazing. And he is discovered, I believe, he's at his mom's diner, and he's fooling around with this, with the title of the song, because it's a story that this Okie Dokie is his name, disc jockey, on some radio station that he's listening to. He uses that phrase, and it catches Price's attention.
Yes, he uses it to advertise Maxwell House Coffee. Lordy, Miss Claudie, you ought to buy, you know, this Maxwell House. I mean, that sort of thing, really hyped up. And, Lloyd Price starts fooling around with that. But during this period, his girlfriend dumps him, and he's got the blues, and he's at his mom's place playing this piano, and he's fooling around with this song. And then he's discovered because Dave Bartholomew, Fats Domino's producer, stops in for a sandwich and hears it.
Isn't that amazing? Who just happened to walk in the door? How much of life is like that, Mark?
Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And, so who cares about the girlfriend? He had a lot of other girlfriends as a result of the hit of the song, right?
Yes, as he points out. I mean, what happens, of course, is that Specialty Records is coming down to New Orleans to tape some new talent, and Dave Bartholomew is responsible for trying to find some local talent that's like Fats Domino. And the best he could come up with, was this kid named Lloyd Price who had this song. And the Specialty Records auditions them. They love the song. And they have him come in, and they have him record it down in New Orleans. And it becomes this huge hit. And, of course, his mom has a jukebox in the little restaurant that she runs. And as soon as this song becomes a hit, she moves all the records down and puts her son's record, the song you just heard, as a number one. Very, very cute.
Did artists have to worry about what was on the flip side, the B side?
Well, they did. But, unfortunately, Lloyd Price didn't at the time. He didn't realize he had to come up with a second song for the back. That's thrown together like right there at the recording session, this blues that they Mailman Blues, I think it is, or something like that, where they have to quickly put together a song to cover the B-side. So, that's how that song came about also.
So would you call that song R&B?
Yes, that's R&B. And there's a distinction between R&B and rock and roll. R&B is really something that comes off of jump blues that had begun about 1945 as the African-American migration moves from the South to the West and the North for World War II factory jobs. They bring with them the music. And this music becomes urbanized, meaning like instead of it being Delta blues, it starts to get jumped up with horns and flash and flamboyance. And you get this boogie-woogie jump sound. And by the late 1940s, more of that music is being moved from the orchestra to the combo. And it's mostly adult music at that time, Kathleen. A lot of these people don't realize, like a lot of this early music, it turns up in bars and jukeboxes where kids can't go. But it's not until this period when the FCC starts giving licenses away to independent radio stations that kids discover the music late at night, turning the dial. And then rock and roll is really something different that happens in 55 when kids sort of rebel against parents and against institutions and against teachers. It has a different attitude.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the importance of this song. We were talking about the origins of R&B. Eventually, Mark writes, white artists figured out how to sing and play the music authentically. And by the early 50s, this song was a huge hit, and it was featured during the opening credits of the film Blackboard Jungle, which helped this song to become the first rock and roll single to hit number one on Billboard's pop chart. I'll give you a second to think about what it is. All right, and now we'll play it, and we'll hear Mark talk about it.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on. Join me, hot. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes one. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. We're going to rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. When the clock strikes 2, 3, and 4.
Comets and Rock Around the Clock Tonight. I haven't heard that song in a long time either.
It's still electrifying, isn't it?
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so this was the first rock and roll number one Billboard hit? Really?
Yeah, in other words, what happened is it was recorded about a year earlier, and it went no place. Didn't even dent the charts. And it's not until the director of the movie and the producer of the movie decide after, this is the Blackboard Jungle, the film that was almost like a documentary about how nasty and mean juvenile delinquents were in urban schools and how they were rebelling against teachers and fighting teachers. And the director and the producer, they needed a song for this that would open this movie up. They didn't quite know what to find. And then the director heard his son was playing this record in his room, and he said, wow, this would be perfect. And they used that recording to open up the movie. And when they do, all the kids who were going to this movie, Blackboard Jungle, in 1955, they're dancing in the aisles to this music. And the music really becomes this this song of rebellion for kids, the song of fighting back against parents who really didn't give them the time of day, teachers who were mean. It was a big song for rebellion.
Hmm. And paving the way, you say, tell me how so, for performers like Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley, and Elvis, Carl Perkins, and Buddy Holly.
Yeah. You know, this song really breaks it open in terms of the rebelliousness of it. Up until this point, R&B is mostly a dance form, but it doesn't have that anger or that pushback against parental control and against teacher control and institutional control. And this song really sets up Chuck Berry, it sets up Bo Diddley, it sets up Elvis. I mean, it sets up the entire genre of what became rock and roll.
Mm. We're talking with the author of Anatomy of a Song. Mark Myers is our guest. It's a compilation of 45 of his columns in the Wall Street Journal. Richard in Madison, hi. Something came to your mind.
Yeah, thanks for the program.
Sure.
Going back to Fats Domino, I think it was in 1955 he recorded Ain't That a Shame. But it only became acceptable when Pat Boone recorded it.
Can you tell us that story, Mark?
Well, I mean, you know, Pat Boone was, as Richard points out rightly, the white pop interpreter of this music called R&B.
Mm-hmm.
But the... You know, Ain't That a Shame? You have to keep in mind that Fats Domino had R&B hits, big R&B hits. He was a rock star in 1952. I mean, The Fat Man in 1949, he had a whole string of 3, 4, 5 hits there in the early 1950s, to the point where he was wearing, you know, rings on his fingers and had, you know, sparkly outfits. I mean, he was a very, very big deal early on. He's really the first rock star from the very beginning. But, yeah, you know, Pat Boone popularized it, but you have to keep in mind, it's not so much Pat Boone's fault or anybody's fault. The charts were highly segregated back then. You had the R&B chart, you had the pop chart. Rarely did the two overlap for reasons we're talking about. It's not until the rise of independent radio in the 1950s that kids can turn the dial of these radios at night, and the kids don't care who's African-American or who's white. They just are responding to music no matter who's doing the singing. So it's independent radio and kids sleeping with transistor, you know, with radios by the side of their bed.
Right.
That completely changes the music and integrates it.
Mark Myers, the book is Anatomy of a Song, and we have many other artists to hear from during the course of this hour, including Linda Ronstadt. We'll be hearing from the Marvelettes, the Temptations, the Rolling Stones, and Otis Redding, and others coming up here on the Ideas Network. And hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn with KP Willie, and this, in case you didn't know, is listener-supported Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be back to our music in a moment. It is our year-end membership drive, which means these moments are extremely important. It's time for you to think about how much you have learned from and enjoyed. This is an enjoyment hour that's going on right now. Programs in 2016, and think about how you'd like to keep them going in 2017. And then you take some action with your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we had some action last hour. We
yes,
had heard
sir.
From 18
oh,
new and returning members. So thank
That's
you
great.
So much for those pledges. We have a goal again this hour, but there's some very important news.
Oh, I didn't know about this news, KP.
That's
what is
right.
it?
We have a dollar-for-dollar match.
Excellent.
Up to $1,500.
I love those.
So
excellent.
It's a generous match from current members, including 9XM Leadership Circle members, Nick and Amy. Is it Penn Warden?
I think so.
Yeah, and it means that they'll match every dollar that you give up to $1,500.
That means it's really a good hour to give.
Absolutely.
How can you not? Double your money. And it's their way of encouraging you to join them in supporting Wisconsin Public Radio. So it's double your support, double your money for the programs that you love. Please give now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
You know, people who listen, people just like you, provide the single most significant share of WPR's budget. So your donation is really an investment in Wisconsin Public Radio and in this program and all the programs that deliver the greatest value to you.
Your contribution keeps independent public service radio on the air for you and for the entire community. Give now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
You know, I'm a person that sits down every month and pays all my bills online.
You do?
All at the same time. And I'm done with it.
How
and
responsible of you.
It is. Mm-hmm. And maybe you pay your bills online, and I bet you don't miss all the extra paper and the envelopes that are floating around the house.
Support WPR in that same intelligent, streamlined way that KP does by becoming a sustainer. You choose a monthly amount that works for you. It might be $10 or $20, and then you set it up to come out of your credit card or your bank account. It's rollover each year, so your support will always be current. It's easy. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Here at Wisconsin Public Radio, we've been partnering with food banks throughout Wisconsin since 2010 to help those facing hunger. This drive, when you give $5, $10, or $20 a month, consider a food bank thank you gift. Second Harvest Food Bank CEO Dan Stein shares why this is a powerful choice.
So many people that we serve, when they get towards the end of the month, they really struggle with some tough choices they have to make. And some of those choices are the result of stretching their money as far as it can go, and it just doesn't go far enough. And they have to decide whether to buy food for their family or pay their housing or fill a prescription or put gas in the car. This takes a lot of pressure off them when the food we can provide helps them with that expense. And as a result, they can focus on other things to keep them in their homes.
Through these thank you gifts, we've provided more than 330,000 meals to those in need. This pledge drive is your chance to do two good things at once.
Please make your donation in support of the programs you count on to Two Good Things at Once at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Whether your pledge is $5 a month or $100 a month, we appreciate and we also count on your gift.
That's right. On Wisconsin Public Radio, you get programs that not only inform you, but they also inspire you. And they're programs that entertain and engage you at any time that you want.
And what makes it all possible, you might be questioning?
What?
Well, you do. People who contribute make it happen.
That's right. At Wisconsin Public Radio, your membership really does make the difference. So think about becoming a member with a pledge of maybe $5 a month, whatever amount, $10 a month. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Listening to us makes driving, working, even sitting in your favorite chair a different experience. It's a much better experience.
That's right. And your support makes WPR possible, and it turns ordinary activities into extraordinary activities. So your life is really better with WPR in it. So why not give at WPR.org and help us make it all possible. 888-202-2552.
And please don't let this opportunity go by. We have a dollar for dollar match up to $1,500. So your $100 will be matched by another $100 from generous listeners. They're 9XM Leadership Circle members, Nick and Amy Penwarden. And they will double every dollar that you give.
That's
it is
really
very
incredible.
Generous of them. And it is a way of inspiring you to support WPR. So please choose this hour to give us your support. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
You know, we have a lot of ways to say, make your pledge to Wisconsin Public Radio. We sometimes say, stand up and be counted, or make your voice heard. But you do all of those things, and you really make that difference when you give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Dollar for dollar match still in effect. We have about 36 minutes or so to raise as much money as we can, actually.
Absolutely.
WPR.org, 888-202-2552. Your support will go twice as far.
This hour only. And it is the season of giving, too. So support the radio you love, and you get to do something extra by choosing one of the food bank gifts when you give $5, $10, or $20 a month. So it's a really great time to give. Double your money, double your impact, because you're helping two great organizations. And you give now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Marilyn from Madison says, I want to share all of the excitement of good radio broadcasts with the people of my wonderful Wisconsin.
Oh, that's great.
That's good. Thank you, Marilyn.
So much,
thanks,
Marilyn.
Everybody. This hour, it's a great hour to give. It's double your money. Thanks so much, KP. And we are also welcoming phone calls, because we're talking about 45 iconic hits that changed rock, R&B, and pop Mark Myers is the author of Anatomy of a Song. He is a columnist and writer for the Wall Street Journal, and he's written some other books. And we're having a bit of fun this hour listening to some songs. Here's another one. We want to move into some Motown songs. We're now into the early 60s. We're in the 1950s, so we'll try to do this somewhat chronologically. See if you remember the name of this group. I'm sure that many of you... Hold on, I got to find my thing here to play the song. Many of you will remember this song. So we're moving into 1961. The month is August. And you would have heard this on the radio frequently. August of 1961, do you remember the Marvelettes? And we're going to be talking about that song you heard over and over, and Mark writes about songs that and singles that would become addictive to the ear and then wind up as hits. He'll also talk about congressional investigations going on about that time. Mr. Postman, the Marvelettes, the backstory of this one, Mark, is fascinating as well.
Yeah, Kathleen, it's you know, the music gets very sweet starting in 1961. There's a big change from you know, Little Richard and the music of the late 1950s, and suddenly by the early, very early 1960s, the dawn of the 1960s, you have girl groups and you have love and breaking up and all kinds of things like that. The big turning point were the congressional payola hearings of 1959 to 60 that not only put a halt or tried to put a halt to cash payments by record promoters to disc jockeys to get them to play their records over and over again. That was part of it. The other thing that radio had to sort of succumb to was taking that control out of the hands of the disc jockey and putting it in the hands of the program director, who then made choices. But in the process, Congress really wanted the record industry to back off of rock and roll, to not make it so sexually suggestive, and to sort of tone it down. They were getting a lot of heat from their constituents. So the music got a little friendlier. It got a little bit less innuendo and a little more about, you know, girls breaking up and guys meeting girls and the Beatles and that sort of thing. It got sweet.
Mm-hmm. And this was Motown's first number one hit on Billboard's?
That's correct, on the pop chart.
Mm-hmm.
They had number one. They were doing well on the R&B chart, but this is what they called a crossover. In other words, white households were buying this record as well as African-American households. It was a massive hit right across the board. Every teenager related to this song.
And then what happened with the payola? Did it end right after program directors were instituted?
No. Congress never put any teeth in the bark. They really just were, you know, they gave stern warnings, warned the record industry, warned radio about this stuff, and radio then instituted the program director. But, you know, record companies found ways around it and probably still do today. But it did change how music was written and what became popular and what was pushed and promoted. The song tonality was much younger, and that's, you know, largely because people like Carole King and Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann, young kids, were being hired by the songwriting institutions in New York and Los Angeles to write the songs. They were teenagers, people who were very, very young, writing about their own age group.
Mm. If Berry Gordy's female artists could top the pop charts, no reason why one or more of his male vocal groups couldn't do the same, you write. The key to capture the hearts and imaginations of teenage girls. And so, Smokey Robinson wrote this.
Cold outside, I've got my
Smokey Robinson, and performed by the Temptations, My Girl. I love reading in your piece about this particular song that people all over the world, even though they didn't know what was being said in this song, everybody knows this song, Mark.
Yeah, as soon as you hear James Jamerson's bass line, boom, boom,
yes,
boom, boom, and
yeah,
then you hear
yeah.
Robert White's guitar on the top of that, you know, it's easily Motown's national anthem. I mean, that's probably the most popular of all the Motown songs.
Is it?
Yeah, I mean, the big difference there, I mean, the chance or the risk or the interesting thing that Smokey did is, instead of having Eddie Kendrick sing lead, who had a very high, sweet voice, he wanted David Ruffin to sing lead, who David had a much more gravelly, deeper, masculine voice. And he wanted that because he knew that if that voice became animated as confessing that he loved somebody, that he was being complete, that voice was being completely open, that he was smitten and fully in love, that it would be much more convincing and much more heartfelt. And he was right.
All right, let's skip ahead. We have a lot of songs to get through. Let's go to San Francisco. San Francisco, counterculture refuge. Amazing what went on there in the late 60s and a different kind of music.
Yeah. I mean, you know, San Francisco becomes the center of music largely because of the migration from Los Angeles. Everything was happening in Los Angeles in the very early 1960s. It was a big, big music center. All the studio musicians were there. All the groups were there. But by the late 1960s, with the draft, the Vietnam War, the rebellion, the civil rights movement, Los Angeles starts to crack down on young people loitering around on the Sunset Strip. And you have what are called the Sunset Strip riots, where the police clash with young people who are sort of hanging around there. All of these people then decided to move north to San Francisco. The entire music industry moves up to San Francisco. A lot of people leave suburbia. A lot of young people leave suburbia and college to locate in San Francisco. And as a result, more groups start to play up there because they've got a bigger audience. And a new sound develops, a more psychedelic, hard rock, long form album rock develops in San Francisco in the late 1960s.
And here's one of them talking about kind of psychedelic, and the backstory of Grace Slick is also fascinating, what she was doing in 1966. We'll hear that story in just a moment. Jefferson Airplane, one of the songs included in 45 most iconic of the past 50 years in Mark's latest book. Backstory of Grace Slick and White Rabbit. Anatomy of a Song is what we're talking about this hour with Mark Myers. Mark has compiled 45 of his columns from the Wall Street Journal. He's a regular contributor where he writes about rock, soul, and jazz, as well as the arts. His book is Anatomy of a Song, the oral history of 45 iconic hits that changed rock, R&B, and pop. We have a busy hour going on. I'm not kidding you, because we also have our year-end membership drive going on, and KP Whaley is with me in our Milwaukee studios. Please join in and help. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
That's right. In this hour, we have a dollar-for-dollar match in effect right now.
Hey, we do.
That's right. So current members, including 9XM leadership members, Nick and Amy Penwarden, they are going to match every dollar that you give with another dollar. So if your gift of 50 turns to 100 and 100 to 200 and so on. So please take advantage of this match and double your support for WPR. Double your support for the show when you give right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
KP and Scotty and I have a great deal of enthusiasm for bringing you just terrific conversations every day. They work so hard, and we love, you know, they're difficult topics sometimes, but we just have a mission with what we do. Sometimes it's fun, like we're reliving the past with some of this music. We do very serious conversations about climate change, about political subjects, books. We do history. We did Eleanor Roosevelt last week. We just opened all our worlds to all these wonderful topics. And so you don't get shows like this in many places, and it's, by golly, I mean, so it's possible.
We're getting excited.
I know, pledge by pledge, and it's only on listener-supported WPR. Please give now, and then you can do so at WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And we really couldn't make it any easier for you. It just takes a few minutes to make a contribution, and you'll get so much back. You might even consider a 9XM leadership gift of $100 a month or more.
And that, when you come down to it, is less than $4 a day, and it makes the talk and news and music and entertainment on WPR possible. Give at WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And don't forget, what public radio means really is that it's listener-supported radio.
Absolutely. We get contributions from the federal and state, but listener support is really the largest single
source. The biggest.
Yeah, that's it. You got it. Your contribution is really important. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Hi, I'm Lance from Madison.
And I'm Cheryl.
When did we become sustaining members? Cheryl, I'm trying to remember. It's been quite a while.
Maybe it was about the same time that I moved here. So we've probably been sustaining members of WPR for about 10 years. We had each supported public radio in our respective states, and when I was an Iowa resident, I supported Iowa Public Radio, and Lance supported Wisconsin Public Radio. And so I think when I moved here to Wisconsin, to Madison, we just pooled our efforts and decided to become sustaining members because we realized what a big part of our everyday life WPR had become and felt morally obligated to help support the programming.
Feel good and make a difference right now at WPR.org.
I'm Kathleen Dunn with KP Whaley, asking for your support of WPR. It's our year-end membership drive. Your support, maybe $10 or $20 a month. We thank you for whatever you can give.
That's right. And, you know, we're really passionate about bringing you two great hours of radio from 1 to 3 o'clock, Monday through Thursday. It's, you know, and we love doing it. Scotty, myself, Kathleen, we bring you books, we bring you history, politics, social issues galore. Mm-hmm. And we're here for you with some really important topics, but also really fun topics like this hour.
Yeah, and we can't do it without your support. It's listener contributions that make up 40% of our budget, and that's a whole lot. It's why we're asking for your gift right now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And we still have money in the pot with that dollar-for-dollar match. So up to $1,500, there's a dollar-for-dollar match in effect right now, and it's really a great time to pledge because the current members, 9XM Leadership Circle members, Nikki and Amy Penn-Warden, will double every dollar that you give, but only in this hour. It's really their way of inspiring you to go to the phone right now and dial 888-202-2552.
And please go to the phone now. We don't want to lose the opportunity to get a dollar-to-dollar match, so this is a great hour for you to give your support. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Yeah, help us put a strong finish on 2016 so we can come back and continue to bring you the issues and talk in the months to come. Make your year-end gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we're looking for 7 more people to meet our goal this hour, KP. And
we can do that.
We can do that. So make us reach that goal. Help us. Give now. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And in the season of giving, you can also support the radio you love and do something extra by choosing one of the food bank gifts when you choose a gift of $5, $10, or $20 a month. So if you give now, WPR.org, you can also choose to give to food banks. 888-202-2552.
And thank you very much for all of your support. We're talking this hour, we're having some fun this hour, actually, talking with Mark Myers about his wonderful new book, The Backstories of 45 Iconic Hits That Changed R&B and Pop and Rock, 45 very important songs over the last, well, since the end of the 1940s, 1950s. Anatomy of a Song, the oral history. He has interviews with many of the people who composed these songs or sang the songs of 45 iconic hits that changed rock, R&B, and pop. And we'll continue and talk about Grace Slick in a moment here on the Ideas Network. All right, I feel like I last mentioned Grace Slick a while ago, but it's an interesting story, Mark. What she was doing before she became this huge rock star, she was a model.
Yeah, Kathleen, she was a model at iMagnon in San Francisco, which I don't believe is in business any longer. And she would sort of walk around the floor in her, you know, whatever new creation she was asked to wear, and the women, wealthy women, would see it and ask for it in their size. But at a certain point in 1966, she's had enough, and she notices that the influx of bands, and she notices that, you know, there's lots of opportunity to create a band. So she creates her own. They create their own band called the Great Society, with her brother and her husband and a couple of other guys. And she's the singer. And it's not until about a year later, in 1967, late 66, 67, that she becomes a member of the Jefferson Airplane. And she's really the first female vocalist in the electric rock era. That strong, strident, almost like a whip-like voice. Huge amount of passion there. It's not just, you know, singing something silly or lovelorn. There's a message going on there. There's some sort of call to battle.
Mm-hmm. And then we get a whole string of female artists, and we're going to play a couple of them now, because we're starting to see an examination of the role of women, certainly, and some of the women who are singers aren't necessarily involved in a women's movement, but we're realizing that women have been subservient to men in the rock industry and in many other industries for many years, and all of a sudden, there they are, front and center again.
Yep, yeah, it's absolutely true. Also, keep in mind, you know, large percentage of sales were going to girls who became women. The Beatles were fully, you know, the Beatles were fully aimed at young girls. Girls are the ones screaming at Shea Stadium. Girls are the ones screaming in the streets. You know, women, young girls are buying the Beatles records. And as they get older in the 1960s, they are suddenly realizing that they, too, want civil rights for themselves. Equal rights become much more important in the late 1960s, and the music starts to reflect that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the island of Crete, where Joni Mitchell sang this song. The backstory on this and the picture in the book is also pretty interesting. Here's Joni Mitchell, another of those strong female singers in the late 60s. We'll get the backstory momentarily.
The wind is in from Africa. Last night I couldn't sleep. Oh, you know it sure is hard to leave the carry, but it's really not my home. My fingernails are filthy. I've got beach tar on my feet, and I miss my clean white linen and my fancy French cologne.
She was living in a cave with Carrie in Crete.
Yeah, she was living. She was living in a cave. She had a very bad breakup with Graham Nash, and at that point she really needed to get away. And she and her friend Penelope went off to Crete, and in Matalon, a town on the other side of the island, she was there. The town was called Matala. And there's just caves. If you see pictures of it, it's a cove and there are caves with holes, ancient caves, and that's where a lot of the European and American hippies were living in 1969-70 while they just enjoyed swimming every day and living as rustic a life as you can imagine. And she spent about a month and a half there, and one of the characters she met was somebody named Carrie, a mean old daddy with a cane.
And there's a picture of the two of them in the book.
Isn't that the best?
Yes.
Yeah, Carrie. I tracked down the real Carrie, and Carrie let me use that photo in the book. But, you know, they were together almost all the time for that month and a half period. And when Joni got back, of course, she recorded the album Blue, which is one of the great rock and roll. I mean, it's just one of the
great
female
album.
Rock albums of all time. And, you know, she reflected on her time with him and, you know, the good and the bad.
Mm-hmm. Here's a song that was banned from the radio. You'll know which one I'm talking about. A woman who had three babies before she was 20 years old. And we'll play a little bit and talk about her.
You've been making your brags around town that you've been loving my man. But the man I love, when he picks up trash, he puts it in a garbage can. And that's what you look like to me, and what I see's a pity. You better close your face and stay out of my way if you don't want to go to Fist City. If you don't want to go to Fist City, you better detour around my town. 'Cause I'll grab you by the hair of the head and I'll lift you off of the ground. I'm not a-saying my baby's a saint, 'cause he ain't, and that he won't cat around with a kitty. I'm here to tell you, gotta lay off of my man if you don't want to go to Fist City.
Loretta Lynn and Fist City. That song was banned from radio stations?
Yeah, at first they were afraid that women fighting a woman is just wasn't appropriate, and it just wasn't something. It wasn't a theme they thought would have any resonance at all. But it turned out it became a huge hit, and largely because women were buying it. But if you listen to those words, Kathleen, it's interesting. You know, it's instead of if her husband, the indiscretions of her husband aren't her husband's responsibility. In other words, she's not writing about clobbering her husband for straying. She's clobbering the woman who entered their life and was pulling him away.
Right.
So if you want to keep your look, steer clear of my town, or you'll be going to Fist City.
Yeah. And then when her husband is dying, this woman she sang about in this song came to visit him.
Yeah, she sort of rang the doorbell, and when Loretta opened it, she walked straight in and went to his deathbed to have a conversation with him. And you know, when I interviewed Miss Loretta, she was composed, and she was, you know, telling me about it. And she sort of leaned up close to me on the chair, and she goes, "You want to know something?" She goes, "I can't stand that woman to this day." Very, very funny woman.
Yeah. What a voice, though. I mean, she is front and center on that song, isn't she? Yeah. Here's one of mine that was always one of my favorites, and tell me why it was so many others. And he paved the way for other performers. Everybody will remember this. We're back to the earlier 60s now. Well, I guess later 60s. What year was this one, Sitting on the Dock?
68.
It was 68.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll talk about Otis Redding after we hear a little.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, then I'll watch them roll away again. I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time.
He really sounds like he's sitting on the dock of the bay, doesn't he?
Yeah, and, you know, the ships rolling in imagery never seemed to click with his co-writer there, Steve Cropper. He never quite understood it, and he even pushed back when Otis sang that. He said, "What do you mean ships rolling in, Otis? The ship rolls. It's going to take on water, and it's going to sink. I don't understand that lyric at all." And Otis said, no, Steve, don't worry about it. You know, that's what I saw. Ships were rolling in." And, of course, sadly, 3 days after Otis sang that, for the record, he died in a plane crash in the Midwest. And you know, Steve Cropper never quite understood that meaning of that until he was in Sausalito several years later having a hamburger. And he was sitting there looking out at the bay and watching the ferries cross over from San Francisco to Sausalito when he noticed that the ferry would turn sideways to create a wake, to sort of buffer and slow down the ferry as it came near the dock. And that's, he suddenly realized that's where Otis had been.
Oh.
He had been watching those ferries cross over and create that wake, in Otis's mind or in Otis's lyric, rolling in.
Mm. We don't have time because of our membership drive going on, but I want to hear just a few more of these stories, if not the songs. The inspiration behind Gladys Knight's Midnight Train to Georgia.
Midnight Train to Georgia, that wasn't the name of that song in the beginning. Jim Weatherly, the writer of that song, called his friend up, Lee Majors, the $6 million man. But Lee wasn't home. His girlfriend answered the phone, Farrah Fawcett, who I'm sure you remember as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the model. And she said, look, Jim, I'd love to be able to talk, but you know, Lee's not home. I got to catch a midnight plane to Houston. Yeah. So she gets on the phone. Jim strokes his chin, says, wow, that's a great title for a song. He writes the song. It's a sort of a slow country ballad. His manager then sends it out to all big-name singers, hoping they'll record it, because when they record it, Jim Weatherly would make money. And Sissy Houston decides she wants to record it, Whitney's mom.
Mm-hmm.
But she says, Jim, I got a problem with the title. And Jim goes, what's the problem with the title? And she says, well, look, I don't. My family doesn't come from Houston, and they come from Georgia, and they don't take planes. They take trains. So she named it Midnight Train to Georgia. He was fine with it. And then, of course, Gladys Knight records it after Sissy Houston.
Yeah, there couldn't have been another name for that song. You're terrific. Please join us again when we have more time.
It was
great fun.
Wonderful being with you.
Yeah, great to have you here. The book is Anatomy of a Song. Mark Myers is the author of the book, and he's an interesting guy. He is the columnist for the Wall Street Journal, where he writes about rock, soul, and jazz. The oral history of 45 iconic hits that changed rock, R&B, and pop.
What I'm about to say couldn't mean the world's disaster. Could change your joy and
Wonder. I was just telling KP I want to be a DJ again. This is so much fun. Stevie Wonder also included in that book. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You may know that. KP Whaley is with me in our studios in Milwaukee, and we also have our year-end membership drive going on. You count on WPR for in-depth talk, and occasionally we love doing these music shows, and it's your gift that will make a huge difference. Please give. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Yes, and we want to thank everyone who's made pledges so far. We still need a few more pledges to go this hour. You can help us out and help us meet our goal at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We love doing these music shows every now and then. This one was great fun because it was such a variety from early R&B all the way to rock and roll. It's an example of the fun shows that we do. We're not, you know, always terribly serious. We have some fun, don't
That's
we,
right.
KP?
We sure
have
do.
Fun.
And we also have some substance to it as well. So you're talking
right.
about individual songs with a lot
right.
of history and the backstory, which you're not going to get on just a normal, even
right.
you know, music show on public radio. So
right.
If you appreciate that, please take a few minutes to make this hour and many, many more possible. You can choose a gift amount that works for you. It might be $5. It might be $5 a month. And then make that pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
A great way to share your passion for WPR is becoming a member of 9XM Leadership Circle with a pledge of $100 a month or more. We rely on member support and your support to make great radio.
Yeah, gifts of $100 a month are very important for our future, and it really does help us stay strong and continue to grow. And you can help us with your leadership gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Your gift of $10 or $15 a month, whatever amount you choose, we thank you for that.
Yes, and since we launched our sustainer program, thousands of new members have made the switch from provide that steady stream of support to WPR by making those automatically recurring monthly donations.
You know, you can get headlines and sound bites in other places, but where do you go for in-depth conversation? You go here.
WPR.
Yeah.
And where do you go to help WPR keep going?
Well, you go to WPR.org, KP, or you go to
888-202-2552.
And we are out of time.
Oh, my.
Thank you, KP. Thanks for everything.
And thanks to our listeners, too. They
yes, thanks, everybody.
We did get that dollar match.
Double your money. That's terrific. And thanks very much to Zeb Gozman for producing this show on Anatomy of a Song, and to Katie Madsen Cirrus for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thank you.